WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Depending on which critic you take your cues from, Harold Brodkey is either one of the greatest writers America has ever produced, or the object of a clever literary con job that has been 30 years in the making. Until now, Brodkey's towering reputation as the writer who would produce the great American novel of the century has been built on short stories in The New Yorker and excerpts from an unpublished novel that he's been working on for 30 years. Until now, Brodkey's only published book has been First Love and Other Sorrows, a short story collection published in 1958. Stories that Brodkey has said will appear in the novel have just been published under the title Stories in an Almost Classical Mode. Comments range from the critic Dennis Donahue calling Brodkey a genius, the equal of Proust, to Vanity Fair's James Wolcott, who says Brodkey never learns how to filter out the dust and filler. He's the prisoner of his perceptions. He writes as if his head were in a vibrating vise, and he buries the bulk of stories in an almost classical mode in a mass of mental data. Harold Brodkey is famous for the many revisions he makes on his writing and for the difficulty editors have had in convincing him to trim his stories. I asked Harold Brodkey how he perceives the editing process.
Well, it's a little bit like getting married. I never said this before. I don't know where that came from, but all of a sudden you're aware of somebody looking at the world and your own text in a completely, but in such a different way that there's this incredible jolt. And you can either adjust to it or not. And it really is a kind of battle of, you know, you say to them, why can't you see it this way? And they say, well, why can't you see it this way? But I think what it turns out is that in an editing procedure, the writer is sort of expert on what he knows and on what he thinks language consists of, and the editor represents some sort of reading public. But then if I can say something sort of unpleasant, when I read the stories over, almost all the things I don't like came from the editor.
Let me ask you to read something from your new collection. How about the opening of Largely an Oral History of My Mother?
Okay. There is something odd about voices in memory. Thinking of memory as a chamber, a state or condition of mind, and the mind's running like a machine or a track star, that sort of state. The voice in there, the remembered voice, is strange. In my memory, anyway. There are unmodulated gray sounds and unidentifiable words. I mean, it is a very strange mumble, with the words indistinguishable from each other and from the gray electrical hush of the mind, remembering, running. Sometimes, even with great effort, the words can't be made clear, although I seem to know what the figure, gray-lit, somewhat obscure, is talking about. And if I wash out the figure, if I make the memory purely auditory, I often hear words, phrases, fragments of a sentence, rarely a whole sentence. And what I hear is not the voice of the person who once spoke those words. I mean, the music is missing, the actual sound, the actual pitch and key, the inflections, the writing on the breath thing, by which you recognize a voice on the telephone. None of that is there at all. But suddenly a sentence will appear in my head, and some identifier, some cataloger will say, my mother said that. Ha ha, I think amiably. Yes, she did. That's her voice. But it isn't her voice. It's only her words. It's only part of what she meant.
You have to revive memory a lot for the writing that you do, don't you?
There's really only one way of knowing something, which is to look back on it. I mean, whether it's purely fictional or actually based on a memory. So that part of what I'm doing is setting up an idea system that has to do with cognition, so that the reader, maybe without knowing it, can actually take part. There's a certain kind of authority I don't claim as a writer. It seems to me that the reader and I stand side by side as equals looking at this material, and the reader writes his or her own story alongside or superimposed on what I'm saying.
Perhaps I'm taking the idea of memory too literally here, but I was wondering if you've ever been in psychoanalysis and have tried, and ever tried to use that process as a way of getting the details of your past, of making memory more vivid.
Well, I've tried psychoanalysis a couple of times, but it gets down to a matter of doctrine, to whether the doctor or I'm the better Freudian. And
is it a contest?
Yeah.
Have you ever gone to psychoanalysis to get cured of writing?
Well, actually, in college I did, but that only lasted a day. The psychoanalyst did a really revolting thing. He said I was normal.
That upset you?
My dear, I'm an adopted child and you know, three dead parents out of four. You know that line in The Importance of Being Earnest? But, you know, to lose one parent or something, you know, I forget how it goes, it's sad, but to lose two looks like carelessness. Well, to lose three means you have to write a novel about it, I think. But the doctor saying I was normal. I mean, I know, I would love to be normal.
To explain the reference that you just made to having three parents die, you were actually brought up by your father's second cousin after your mother died. Your mother died when you were 17 months old. When you were getting brought up by your father's second cousin, did you know when you were young that she wasn't your real mother?
Yeah, but I wouldn't believe it. It was just too complicated. The first time the problem was proposed to me was when I was six, and I struggled with it for a couple of weeks or months and then just pushed it to one side. It just wasn't livable. I don't know how to say it in any other way. And it was probably part of what Freud had in mind by repression, but what it felt like at the time was you shove it to one side and you put these things in front of it.
But from the stories, I really get the feeling that you're almost obsessed with trying to capture your birth mother's voice, to know something of her essence, which you can't do in a real palpable way, but you can imagine.
I spend most of my life sort of locked in a room, which is not unlike a womb, right? I mean,
when you're writing, you mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I spend a lot of hours doing that, and then I started thinking that about consciousness. I mean, somebody said, well, clearly, Harold, consciousness is your subject matter. So I started thinking, well, is that true? I mean, it hadn't occurred to me to think of it in that particular way. But then I started thinking, well, you know, consciousness does start in the womb. And what must it be like? I mean, you're sort of swimming around there, right? You don't have any vocabulary. You have practically no sense of yourself because you've been changing all the time. And you start out this little tiny worm thing or whatever, you know. And then I really not only believe in a mystic way, but it seems to me I could argue sensibly. I mean, if I could be sensible and if we had the time, that one's language starts very early and comes from the mother. One sense of language, one sense of logic, one sense of reason. And that's what I spend my life doing, writing. So there's almost no way in which what I do doesn't in some sense recreate this woman. I don't know and never can know.
So it feels like it's as if there's some kind of psychic gene, psychological gene or something that you feel that you've been left by your mother, but you don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah, something like that.
How much do you care about what your reputation is as a writer now and what your reputation will be in the future, how history will treat you? Do you care about that?
No. There are certain basic problems. You want the manuscripts or the text saved and you want them read. And there's a secondary element, which is you have a very firm idea at a certain point of what the value is of the work that you've done, that you've published. And you get very irritated when that value is lied about. And it's hard not to think of, you know, misstatements and wrong-headed criticisms, lies. You can't help thinking that other people know more than they're actually saying. And in some cases that's true, but in some cases, of course, it's not. But in terms of reputation, I've always had, starting in high school, I've always had a certain kind of status. So I don't have the experience of worrying about that or of having to worry about that. I mean, that's not the issue, but it really is for other people and about my work in relation to me.
How about your evaluation of yourself? Are you insecure about your own writing? Do you have faith in it?
Oh, yeah, but what you say privately, or what you know privately, what you think privately, when you say it publicly, it becomes a kind of joke. You know this about yourself. If you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror and you make some sort of decision about your face, and you say it to your husband or your lover or whatever, they always burst out laughing. And my private evaluation of myself would, you know, would just produce a certain kind of laughter. So we'll skip that, won't we?
We'll keep that private.
All right.
Okay. Thank you so very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Writer Harold Brodkey on Fresh Air.